Right, I'm sorry about the problems with the lecture note there. I actually sent this lecture note to the ITO early last week, and it was so much in advance that they forgot about it. So then I went to collect it just before the lecture, and it hadn't been copied. So sorry about that. Anyway, you can I have quiet, please. So you all have a copy of the lecture note now, and we're now starting the very last part of the course, which is finally about the analysis of data. So this course is called Data and Analysis. We've done plenty about data, how it's structured and how it's stored and how we access that data, but we've not done really anything so far about how we analyze data. And of course, one of the most useful techniques for analyzing data is to perform statistical tests on data. So actually the last part of course is going to be about statistics and how we do statistical analysis of data, and it might be rather a dry subject in some ways. I'm going to hopefully try to enliven it a little bit by having some real examples, but it's also an important topic because statistics is obviously very much used in many walks of life, but also by politicians, and a lot of analysis about problems in the world comes with statistical analysis. And as you all know, statistics, it's very easy to not just to use them, but also to abuse statistics. So it's important to actually understand what is going on when people say something about statistics, so that you can be aware of the ways that people can try to mislead you by misusing statistics. Anyway, so what we're going to do today is look at just some of the very basic techniques that one uses for analyzing data. And two goals for this were, well, this is part of the unstructured data part of the course. So the idea there is one might have the data given to you. For example, you've performed some experiment or some survey, and you've got the data associated with that. And you don't know what patterns there are in that data. That's what you want to find out. So the goal of the analysis is to discover these patterns in the data, find implicit structure that's present in the data. And statistics is going to provide the tools for being able to quantify those patterns, to say with what degree of certainty we can be sure that those patterns actually exist. And sometimes we might even have a guess about what sort of pattern should be in the data. We're going to see an example of this. This would be called a hypothesis about the data, because we're hypothesizing that the data should have some pattern in it. We're going to have an example of a hypothesis later in today's lecture, and that hypothesis is going to be either confirmed or refuted in next week's tutorial. Okay, and as I said, statistics provides essentially a scientific tool which we can use to confirm, corroborate, or also refute a hypothesis that we're trying to trying to look for. And the power of it is that it gives us a scientific method, because it comes with quantitative values. We can say with this degree of certainty we can find a pattern like this in the data. Now, the first thing, in order to understand what kind of statistical tests you can perform, the first thing is to look at what kind of data you've got. So as you will all be aware, there are two basic kinds of data: are quantitative data, where the data comes with a numerical value, and qualitative data, where you don't have a numerical value, but you have some description of a data. But this is rather a coarse division between these two kinds of data, quantitative versus qualitative. To be able to talk about what we can do statistically in order to analyze data, we need a more fine-grained division of the different kinds of data we're looking at. And this is provided by what are called data scales. So the qualitative data comes in two different, well, we're going to look at two different data scales for it, called categorical and ordinal. And quantitative, that's numerical data, we're going to look at another two different scales called interval and ratio. And as we go from categorical to ordinal, interval, ratio, the data becomes more informative. So a categorical scale, this is if we've got some data, it's qualitative, we don't have a number associated with it, but it's one of a fixed number of categories. So there are two examples on the slide, but I'm just going to go through one example. So for example, if you make a visa application to the UK government, then your visa application is going to be classified according to what nationality you come from. So nationality, there are a fixed number of possible nationalities you can have in the world, and so that is an example. There's no relationship, no order relationship or anything like that between them. So that is an example of a categorical data scale. Now, when I've presented all four data scales, I'm going to ask you in the audience to suggest one example of each kind of data scale. So in the back of your mind, while I'm talking about the other data scales, please try to think of another example of a categorical data scale. The next one up in terms of getting slightly more information associated with the data is an ordinal scale. So that's, again, we've got a categorical data scale in that we've got a fixed number of categories that the data can belong to. But this time, there's an order between them. So an example of that is the Beaufort wind scale, which is used to classify the strengths of winds, which this assigns a number from 0 up to 12, where 0 is absolute calm, and 12 is the strongest wind possible, which is called hurricane. So that's a hurricane force wind. Each of these numbers has an associated adjectival description with it, saying a descriptive classification too, saying what it means in words. So we've got just 13 different categories here from 0 to 12. Every wind will be classified according to one of those, depending on its speed. And so there's obviously an order associated with those. But although they're given numbers, it doesn't make sense to perform numerical operations on them. So for example, it doesn't really make good sense to say that a wind of scale 6, strong breeze, is an average between, so if you average the numbers 0 and 12, you would get 6, but it doesn't really make sense to say a strong breeze is an average between calm and hurricane. So we don't perform arithmetic operations. So the ordinal scale, we've just got the fixed set of categories and the order relation between them. So once again, I'm going to ask you at the end, when I've presented all four scales, to come up with an example of another example of an ordinal scale. Not the other one that I've got on the slide here. An interval scale. So now we're going into the different kinds of quantitative data where we actually have numerical values, and we're going to have two different scales of numerical values. The interval scale is we've got numerical values, so they're typically real numbers, but they might also be integers rather than real numbers or even rational numbers. They're typically real numbers. And an interval scale is a numerical scale in which we have a notion of the relative value between the relative distance, if you like, between two values, but there isn't really an absolute value associated with it. So a good example of this is points in time. So we measure time in terms of seconds and hours, and then the date where the date is calculated based on zero. The starting point for counting the years is in the Western world is 0 AD. So the year that we've designated as zero, but that's kind of arbitrary. And if we have an experiment where we're talking about times of things, we'll talk about the time relative to some arbitrarily chosen starting point for the experiment. So what we're interested in is just really the relative value of our time with respect to our chosen starting point. But it doesn't typically make sense to say of two different times that one time is twice as big as another time. Unless, of course, you're talking, sometimes it does, if you're talking about the length of time something takes, then you can say, well, this takes twice as long. But if you're just talking about the time something occurs, then it doesn't make sense to say, well, it does make sense to say this particular event is exactly at a time exactly twice the distance, for example, from 00 hours on the 1st of January, 0 AD, as another event. But that wouldn't be something you'd really want to do in practice. So relative distances, the relative values, the distance between values is important, but not the absolute value itself. interval scale. So again, I want you to try to think of another interval scale. And a ratio scale is a numerical value in which you do have an absolute notion of zero. So it does make sense to, for example, add numbers and also talk about one number being twice as big as another. And many physical quantities, such as mass, energy, length, these are measured on a ratio scale because we have an absolute idea of what zero length means, for example. And there's a sort of rather flippant question here for physics students. Is time a ratio scale if one uses the Big Bang as its zero point? Well, you can think about that if you want. It's not really a serious question. But anyway, the point is that we've got these four different data scales, and we're in, and I'm going to use this later, so I'll put, so in order of information, we've got the categorical, which just gives us the category. We've got the ordinal, where there are a set of categories, but there's an order relation between them. Interval, where we've got a numerical value, but we don't have an absolute numerical value. We can just talk about the difference between values. And we've got ratio, where we have an absolute value. Okay, so as I said, I'm going to ask you to suggest examples of each of the data scales. So did anyone think of another example of a categorical data scale? Sorry? Yes, gender. So if you're just ticking a box, are you male or female, then there are just two fixed categories. And there's no order between them, so it is indeed a categorical scale. Right, so example of an ordinal scale. Anyone got a good suggestion of that?
Generations.
Sorry?
Generations.
Pardon?
Generations.
Oh, yeah, you could talk about generations of people, I suppose. It's a bit, which generation someone belongs to is often quite a hard thing to say. Exactly. I mean, within a family, you can do that. So that's a reasonable suggestion. Anyone else? Pardon? Sorry, where are you?
Richter scale. What?
Richter scale,
like earthquakes, but it's not.
The, what's it called?
The Richter
scale, yes. The Richter scale for earthquakes. I'm not sure, because I think that's actually numerical. It's on a logarithmic scale of in terms of a measure of force, and it's actually, it's not just a fixed number of categories, because you get sort of 6.3 on the Richter scale, for example. So I think the Richter scale is actually, let's have that as a ratio. Well, we wouldn't actually add, because it's a logarithmic scale. That's a subtle one. So it has an absolute zero, but you wouldn't add elements on the Richter scale. So that's somehow a different kind of numerical scale, which is a logarithmic scale. Okay, well, anyone else suggest an example? Yeah, okay, very good. Happiness ratings. And that might seem a funny one, but actually it's not, because on questionnaires, so this is what you're thinking of, on questionnaires you often get questions like, how happy are you with this policy of the government or something like this? Very happy, a little bit happy, not at all happy, terribly unhappy, or something like that. So that's an example, that's a very good example questionnaire where you indeed get a fixed number of categories and there's a clear order between them. Right, anyone thought of something on the interval scale? Okay, well, let's not spend too long on this. So another example of something on the interval scale would be, for example, grid reference coordinates on a map, where the zero you've got is just relative to your arbitrarily chosen grid reference on a map, and then what you're interested in is the displacement in the x and y direction there. And a ratio scale, any example of a ratio scale? Okay, well, here's another one that was length mentioned? Yeah, oh, it's already, well, basically there are, maybe, okay, to put time in, duration. would be an example of a ratio scale. There's an absolute notion of an event taking zero duration, and then we're measuring the length of time that something takes from its starting point. Okay, so let's carry on. And so we've got some data. It belongs to a data scale, and we want the idea. We've got unstructured data. We don't know what the patterns in the data are. We want to find these patterns. So to do this, a standard technique that you use is you visualize the data by drawing it in some appropriate, plotting it in some appropriate way using what's called a histogram or a bar chart or some other things. This is basically secondary school or even primary school material. You often meet bar charts at school, so I'm not going to give examples on the slides of these things, but we'll see examples when we look at our real-world data a little bit later in the lecture. But for a collection of data from interval or ratio scales, one often plots, for example, a graph where the x-axis is the value of the data and the y-axis is the frequency with which you see the data. And often, and this is an important shape to remember, often the data looks like this, where you've got a particular value which appears most often, roughly in the middle, and then it sort of dies off in this bell-shaped curve. And as probably many of you know, this is called a normal distribution of data. And the reason for highlighting this is that this is a kind of picture that arises very often, or at least something like this picture, that most of the data, that the most common data is kind of in the middle, and then as you go further away, you get this sort of bell-shaped picture. And we're not going to see examples of this in our real-world data today, but the real-world data we're going to look at in Friday will, to some extent, or at least it should. I haven't actually drawn the graph yet, but hopefully it will look something like that. I haven't actually plotted the data yet to see. And when you get something like this, there are two natural statistics that are used. One is where the data is clustered, so sort of the middle point of the data, which is the mean of the data. As you all probably know, mean means average. So the average of the data is, in this case, the middle of the data here, which is zero. And then there's a measure of the spread of the data, so how much of the data, how close in general is the data to the center point. This is called the standard deviation. When you've got a normal shaped curve, the standard deviation represents the distance from the center point to the place in which the curve turns from becoming concave, which means it's turning this direction, to convex, which is the time it starts to become flatter as you go down. And so the point of inflection, as it's called here, from where it turns between concave and convex, actually is at the one mark here. So the standard deviation that measures the spread of the data of this example is one. So quite often you get something looking like this normal distribution. Here's the formula for a normal distribution. You don't need to know that formula for the course, for the exam. It's just it's a useful formula to know in life, so it's just there if you like mathematical formulas. And the mean, as I said, is the center point, and the standard deviation is where the curve changes from being convex to concave. But the point about these measures, such as mean and standard deviation, probably as many of you already know, these measures can be used also in situations in which your data does not conform to this this bell-shaped curve. So also, if you don't get a normal distribution, you can still talk about the mean as a kind of average or focus point of the data, and the standard deviation as a measure of how far the data spreads away in general from that focus point. So what we're going to look at now is just a simple collection of what are called summary statistics, which means the statistic here means a value that we're associating with the data, a measure of something, and the summary statistic is summarizing some aspect of the data. For example, its cluster point would be summarized by the mean, and its spread is summarized by the standard deviation. Let me just put, I'm going to a little bit use the board as well. Right, so we're going to look at various different summary statistics, most of which you've probably met before. So the point is, there are different ways of measuring the cluster point, where the data tends to cluster, and they're appropriate for different kinds of data. So a very simple one is called the mode, which is just a value or the values that occur most often in the data. So if our data were this, 6236151725 6, we just see that the most common value occurring is 6, which occurs 3 times, and no other value occurs less than that. So that's a simple way of saying this is somehow the, in a sense, the where the data clusters around, because it's the most common value. And the good thing about the mode is that this makes sense for all these forms of data. So it also you can also talk about the mode of categorical data. So we'll put mode up here. This makes sense for all these forms of data. But there's a caveat on interval and ratio data, which is if you've got real valued data, it doesn't really make sense to look at the most common real value that occurs, because there are infinitely many, in fact, uncountably many, for those who know the mathematics, real values that can occur. So you're unlikely to get real values occurring more than once. But if you've got numerical data with an integer value, it does make sense. So there's a caveat on interval and ratio data. The mode does not make sense for real value data. But it does for integer valued data. Because then, well, there are infinitely many integers, but if you tend to be measuring within fixed boundaries, and you are likely to get the same number occurring several times. It's a discrete categorization rather than a continuous categorization. So the next one up is the median. And here what you do is you have your, so it's the same data as we had before. You arrange it in ascending order, and then you count the middle occurrence. So in this case, there are, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, there are 11 values. So we take the middle value, which is the sixth one, and that's 5. So in this case, the median is 5. But in order to be able to calculate the median, you need to be able to arrange your values, your data values, in order. So, of course, that needs to have, you need to have data from the ordinal scale there. So the median does not make sense for categorical data. It does make sense for ordinal data, interval data, and ratio data. Then there's the mean, which is the standard average. As I hope you all know, the formula's here anyway, but as I hope you all know already, that you just add up your data values and divide by the number of data occurrences to get the average. And of course, for this, you need to be able to perform this arithmetic operation of adding up and dividing by the number, that taking an average. And in fact, one of the properties of an interval scale is that you can form what are called weighted averages, and this is an evenly weighted average. So interval scales, so mean can be performed for interval scales, but it can't be performed for ordinal and categorical scales, because these are qualitative data rather than quantitative, they're not numerical, so we can't perform the arithmetic operations on those. And then the standard deviation, that's the measure of the spread, well, you do that by you first calculate what's called the variance, which is just the average. So we've calculated the mean, which is, I should have said, the symbol for the mean is this mu, Greek letter mu. So we calculate the difference from the mean, and we square it, and we find the average of the square difference in distance from the mean. So we're doing an average here over n. And that's called the variance, and the standard deviation is the square root of this variance. And this, again, makes sense. Standard deviation and variance also make sense for interval data and ratio data. So these are the summary statistics we're going to be looking at. 3 different measures of where we cluster, the mode, the median, and the mean, which makes sense for different kinds of data. And the main notion of spread is the standard deviation, which makes sense just for the forms of numerical data, the interval and ratio data. Okay. And there's an example of a calculation of variance and standard deviation. As always, I'm not going to go through the calculations in the lecture notes. Right, so I think it's now time to take a break and look at some real-world data and have a look at these concepts on that. So if you cast your minds back to the very first data and analysis lecture 9 weeks ago today. Right, can I have quiet, please? So there was a questionnaire in the first data and analysis lecture in which you were asked to fill in the questionnaire. It was voluntary. You didn't have to participate. I don't know. We got 112 responses that were usable from that. Oh goodness, we've got this issue with the laser pointer here. Oops. I better click. It's the usual Windows thing, the laser. Well, so I shall just wave in the vague direction. So you were asked to your nationality, whether you were UK, Irish, European, but not UK, Ireland, or other, so another nationality. So what kind of data scale is this? This data, sorry? Categorical, that's right. So there are just three categories here. UK, Irish is one. European, not UK, Ireland, is another. And other is anything else. And you were asked for the previous week before the questionnaire how many hours of physical exercise, where this was taken to mean actual sporting physical exercise you'd done, and how many units of alcohol you'd consumed in the last week. Remember, a unit of alcohol is roughly one small glass of wine corresponding to about a seventh of a bottle of wine or half a pint of beer or one measure of spirits. So we got 112 usable answers from that, and this here they are on an Excel spreadsheet. So I'm not obviously going down the list, it doesn't show very much, so I want to show some examples of how one can visualize this kind of data. So let's have a look first at the nationality. Well, so there were these three categories for the nationality, so how would we visualize this to see the spread of nationalities? Obviously, it's a bit crude, just these three categories, but one way of doing that you're probably familiar with is you cut the things up into what's called a pie chart showing the proportion. So here we've got in blue the UK Irish, in red the European, and in yellow the others. And in fact, it's a bit hard to see from the pie chart in this case, but the UK Irish is very slightly the largest contingent. I think it was just two different with the Europeans, and there's about a quarter of the class is from other nationalities that are non-EU. Okay, so that's a very simple thing you can visualize. It doesn't actually tell us very much in this case. Let's have a look at the exercise data. So here, this is an example of a bar chart or histogram. So here we've got at the bottom, so we turned everything into integers, so we rounded the non-integer figures to integers. So we've got 0 hours exercise on the left up to the maximum 18 hours exercise that somebody said they did on the right. So that's like 3 hours exercise a day with a rest day on Sunday. I don't know, you don't need to own up to this, but I'm just, in case you want to, is the person who did 18 hours of exercise that week here? Would they like to explain? Are they some sports star or something? Does anyone want to own up to that? No. Okay. Sorry?
He's training right now.
could well be training right now. So anyway, I don't know if this is genuine, but we decided that this is within the bounds of physical possibility to do 18 hours of physical exercise a week. So it was left. And you see this kind of, so it's not a normal distribution here. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The the data goes from zero. There are most people, I mean, the highest number of is 0 hours, but then quite a lot of people are doing up to about 6 or 7 hours of exercise a week, and then just the higher exercise, just a few people. So we can get a good feeling for the data there. So I've actually calculated the mean, the mode, the median, and the mean of this data. Can anyone tell me what the mode is just straight off? Yeah, many of you said. So zero, I mean, the mode is just the most common value. So it's clearly zero on this. The median is, if we arrange everything in line, where's the median going to be? So can anyone guess roughly what the median and mean are in this case? Just rough?
Five.
Okay, let's have a look. We'll go to the... and we go down here to the table at the bottom. So the mean is, in fact, for the exercise, the median is 2, indeed. So it's just, if you put them all in a line, you'll see the middle value. There were 112 answers, so the middle value will be around, in this case, where the sort of 56th entry in the list. And if you look, the 56th entry will be in 2, if we go back to the thing. The mean is actually higher at 2.9, nearly 3. Let's go back to the picture again. So where is it? Exercise data. So if we see the 56th entry should be, so we've got 30 for 0, 15 for 1, that takes us up to 45, and another 15 for 2. So indeed, that takes us to 60 with up to 2 hours exercise. So indeed, the median is in the right place. Can anyone give a qualitative explanation of why the mean is higher in this case? So an explanation of why, with a picture like this, you would expect the mean to be higher than the... Pardon? Exactly, because the mean takes account of the extreme values and what they are, and they're quite high in this case. We've got quite a large spread of the data, whereas the median is just about, so which position are you if you order the data? So indeed, there are high values in this case, and that's reflected by the higher mean. Okay, so let's have a look at the alcohol consumption. So in this case, we did filter an entry because somebody claimed 4,000 units of alcohol in a week, and we decided that was physically impossible. On the other hand, the highest one we left in was 75 units. That amounts to a bottle and a half of wine every day for a week without a rest on Sunday. So I'm not going to ask... Maybe the person who did this wouldn't mind identifying themselves, but I'm not going to ask them to. We'll keep that anonymous here. So again, we've got the same kind of picture as before. We've got actually quite a large number drank no alcohol. And, sorry, I didn't hear that. Or, okay, you didn't want me to hear it. Okay, so anyway, so again, the same kind of picture, and if we look at these statistics, yet again, we'll get, where is it? So we get, again, in this case, oh, what's going on here? Oops. We get a much higher mean, in this case, nearly 10, than the median, which is 5. Anyway, we can't see that much from this way of displaying the data. In particular, we can't see anything to do with the nationality. I mean, I've just been displaying the number of people.
I should have actually said one other thing about, so for example, the alcohol here.
In order to make a reasonable bar chart, I grouped things in. So the 0 is actually 0. The 5 is 1 to 5. The 10 is 6 to 10 units. So everything... So I group things into blocks in order to get a good representation of the distribution
to smooth out fluctuations from between individual numbers. Right, so let's go to, and again, the mode is 0. But if we wanted to also take into account the nationality, Well, so a reasonable way of displaying all the data is to do what's called a scatter plot. So here's, oh, goodness me. So, whoops. Oh no, what have I done? I shouldn't have done that, should I? Whoops. I don't normally. Here we are. I don't normally use Windows, so. Everybody knew what was going to happen apart from me. So let's go to the scatter plot. Right.
So here I've got the European people in blue, the UK Irish ones in yellow. I'm not sure, I don't know how well clearly you can see that, but I'll put this on the web page. The very high alcohol consumption was the UK Irish person, perhaps unsurprisingly. Our sporting stars, both of them are European, not British. And the, and the others are the pinks there. So the way this is done is that every dot is a person, and we've got the units of alcohol on the y-axis here, and the sporting hours on the x-axis, and we just put a dot of the right colour for the individual entry for the person. And it's quite good at showing the data, except that there's a lot of clustering here on the zero place, so actually you can't really see very well the data there. You can't get a good idea about what the average or anything like that is there. But what we do notice is it seems like there's what's called a little bit of a correlation here between the at least the people who are doing a lot of sport and not consuming very much alcohol, and the people who are consuming the most amounts of alcohol are not doing very much sport, but they are doing some sport, which is probably contributing to them becoming so thirsty, or something like that. So anyway, one might wonder questions about this, and the goal of next week's tutorial is to investigate two hypotheses about the data. Firstly, there is a correlation, meaning a relationship, we'll see that in the next lecture, between exercise and alcohol consumption. So that's hypothesis one. And hypothesis two is that UK Irish students drink more. So these are the two hypotheses that are going to be tested from this data with statistical tests, so we can be able to say with confidence that our, significance that our values are correct. These are the two hypotheses we're going to test. Okay, let's go back to the lecture material now, and we've got 9 minutes to finish the... Right. So everything so far in the lecture has been, including the example, has been about we're calculating statistics where we have all the values available to us. But in general, you're often interested in a situation, for example, you're doing an opinion poll, and there are many examples of, almost the most common uses of statistics follow this same general pattern, where it's totally impractical to get data for the whole population. So for example, an opinion poll, you'd want data for the whole population would be all the people eligible to vote, which is impossible to get data from all of them. So instead, you necessarily choose a sample of the population, and you get data on that, and then you want to calculate statistics based on the data you've collected from your sample, that's a sub-collection of the population, to infer information about the population as a whole. So there are very many examples of that. I've mentioned one, opinion polls, many other examples mentioned on the slide. There's no point going over them. I think you're all familiar with the idea of needing a sample. So how do we go about obtaining a sample. Well, this is a bit like the kind of issues we addressed also in the material on corpora, where we needed to get a representative sample of the language type for the corpus that we were building for the language type. And so just in the same way, if we want to avoid building any bias into the sample we're collecting, well, what we want to do is firstly choose the sample randomly, because that avoids that's automatically not putting a bias in, because randomness is exactly the absence of bias. But also, we want to make the sample as large as we can practically deal with, because the larger the sample, the more representative it's going to be of the population as a whole. And then, given our sample, so the general situation is we've got a population size which we're going to write with a capital N to represent that it's a big number, and we have a sample size, that's the number of people number of subjects we're questioning or collecting data on. So that's going to have a number, and we write that with a small n, because typically it's much smaller than the population size. And we have the values associated with our little n. We've got little n items of data. We're going to use those to estimate the statistical values for the whole population. So we can do that. We can estimate the mean just by calculating the mean of the sample. And that is the best estimate that we can get from our sample of the mean of the population. However, if we want to estimate, as we quite often do, the spread of data, the standard deviation, rather than using the formula for the standard deviation for the sample, which would be to sum, well, here's the variance, we sum the distance from the mean. So we're now using, by the way, the convention here is that you use Roman letters, like M here, for mean when it's the sample mean, and the Greek letters such as mu and sigma for the standard deviation when it's the population mean and sample. So here we're taking the spread of the square of the distance from our sample mean, but instead of just finding the average of it, which would be dividing by our sample size at little n, in order to estimate the variance and then the standard deviation by a square root, we instead divide by n minus 1. So this is a curiosity that can be mathematically justified for estimating standard deviation from a sample. And I want to, now this is non-examinable what I'm going to say, but I want to try to give you a little bit of a flavor for why we use an n minus 1 there. It looks very curious when you first see it. So I'm going to try and do this pictorially. So our population looks something like this. We've got, so suppose this is the scale. We're measuring values on this scale, for example, age of the population. We want to find the standard deviation of the age of the population. So we take our, so that our population is all these different people that, there may be some very old people up here, very young people down here, and we'll put the data analysis class here at the young end, and I don't know. Anyway, so this is our population. And then we construct, and so the population is going to have a mean. Well, we're quite a lot of young people, so maybe population mean is something like this. And now we find our random sample. So, whoops, let's see who falls into our sample. So these people have fallen into our sample, so where I've shaded them in. So we now find our sample mean, and it looks to me, I mean, I haven't done it, but I haven't calculated it, of course. It looks to me like the sample mean is sort of somewhat over here. So it's quite a way different from the population mean in this case. Now, if we were going to do the best estimate of the standard deviation from our sample, the ideal thing we would do would be to take to do the distance from the population mean and take the average of the square of the distance from the population mean and then square root that. But But we don't have the population mean, we don't know it, we've only got an estimate to it. So instead we're taking what we have to do, which is we're taking the distance from the sample mean. But overall the sample mean is going to be more in the middle of our sample data than the population mean. And that means that if we average the standard deviation for the sample mean, we would get a lower value than if we averaged it for the real population mean, if we took the distances from the real population mean. There's less of a spread from the sample mean than there is from the real population mean. So we need to adjust that by making our estimate it needs to be a slightly higher number. And so we divide by n minus 1, and you can mathematically prove that n minus 1 is the right number to divide by. And the reason for that is that somehow the sample mean, once you've got the sample mean, then once you pick n minus 1 elements of the sample, given the sample mean, that determines the other element of the sample. So that's the reason it's n minus 1. I mean, it's a little bit subtle. I'm just trying to give you a flavour of the kinds of considerations that go into that. Anyway, so this slightly funny formula with an n minus 1 is the formula we use for estimating the standard deviation from a sample. There's a word of caution here because sometimes people are not very precise about this difference between samples and populations. I mean, especially in social science textbooks on statistics, they tend to just give you the n minus 1 formula without mentioning that it's really about estimating some other value. So just be cautious there. And when you have calculators with statistical buttons on, you sometimes even have a sigma n for the population standard deviation and a sigma n minus 1 for the sample deviation. Right, and here are some other books you can look at. I think the more interesting ones are these ones at the bottom. It's a very famous book at the bottom, How to Lie with Statistics. The point of today's lecture and the lectures in this course, one of the points is to give you a sufficient feeling for statistics that you won't be taken in by when people try to lie with statistics, as I'm afraid to say politicians do all the time. Okay, it's 12 o'clock. Are there any questions? Okay, so see you again on Friday.
No, I think we're going to have to get a numbering scheme for a second semester because so many people got confused. I mean, I got confused about the weeks at one point, yeah, because of innovative learning week.
Yeah.
I think we have to have teaching week 1, teaching week 2, teaching week 3.
Yeah,
or something
well,
like that.
I don't know. I think just happy to have a week off.
Yeah, I know, but it confused a whole load of people.
Know,
lots of people. I mean,
mindset.
I set the deadline wrong for this class,
uh-huh.
for example, and had to extend it by a week.
I think I was on top of that.
Taku ended.
So
Kaku ended up putting a fourth year deadline right on top of the dissertation submission date.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Is
that going to be addressed?
Yeah. Yep. But it's not an uncommon feature, actually. It's something that he does fairly routinely. But Hutaku?
Yeah.
No, he's been here for ages. Yeah, he's kind of, he exists in a parallel universe as far as I'm concerned. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, you can tell him something, but then it doesn't always stick. Oh, okay. But you don't need me for anything, do you? Is everything? Haven't been any unusual ones lately.
Not at the moment.
But you let me know. Okay. Right.